analoginya dan mau kalah apa? Yes, okay, Mike. Honorable members, good morning and welcome to another committee meeting. And I invite apologies from the secretary. Apologies.
Thank you very much. And good morning, honorable members. Chair, I have got five apologies. The first one is from honorable Kalyan. She's got other engagements. And honorable Mangu is also attending other meeting. And honorable Dati will join us a bit later. She's attending the Children's Forum. And I've got two apologies from Deputy Minister and Nomai Jabegeto. And no deputy minister, Abu Lander. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Just to clarify that Honorable Helen, the other commitment is at PAP. That PAP committee and African Parliament.
That sounds better. Because PAP should an African state was going to be PAP. The agenda is before us. We are going to take a presentation from the department on the political situation or political crisis on Lesotho over a period of time and the interventions that have been made in this regard. So we said we need a briefing on this, but we will also take a discussion on a presentation and later a discussion on the political situation or political crisis in Burundi. So we have requested the department to come and give us a briefing because our work, which deals with international relations and development in the international domain, means that from time to time we must be briefed and be updated on the development around the world from time to time in the UN, in the AU, Syria, Ukraine, countries like that, all of these things. The current developments between Dubai and the USA, they're going to be a visit there. There are all sorts of things. We will from time to time indicate a topic around which you as a department did it occur, must refer. I now want to ask my colleagues whether the agenda is fine as you see it. It's a presentation to Sotho and Burundi, and then we discuss. And then on the second item, which is number five, the committee draft strategic plan. And this draft strategic plan comes from the strategic planning session that we took. Then we looked at the plan, and we have tried to align it to the strategic goals of Parliament as were required. Then there were areas, small area objectives that we said the content advisor must look at that we could not look at. And of course, the number of meetings, or visits or whatever, which must get into the ATP. So I think he's going to deal with that. And for the day, I suspect that will be enough. Can I hear you on the agenda, committee member? Honorable Rafuti.
Good morning, Chair. I move for the adoption.
Thank you very much. Do I hear a second now?
Seconded.
Thank you very much. DDG Makaye Kolisa. DDG Kolisa Makaye Mahaya, ne? Mahaya. Has been deployed or sent by the department to amend workers through two presentations on Lesotho and then later on Burundi. Leave no stone unturned. Including whether we should connect you to two. Want your advice then. On a light note, you know what? On a light note. And I withdraw. What do you want to come here? Yeah. Then.
Honourable Chairperson, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee, good morning. My name is Kolisa Makaya. I'm the DDG for Africa. I've been requested by the Minister and DG, as the Chair has indicated, to come and brief the committee on the current situation in both Lesotho and Burundi. We will then, as the Chair has directed, start with Lesotho. The table of contents you will see is our presentation will just have a little background on the situation in Lesotho and the indicated SADC intervention, the elections that were held in February last year, 2015, and what we call return of instability, because the understanding that we had as a region in particular was that post-election 2015, February, Lesotho was now entering a new phase of stability. And then the started response again following those disruptions, the Commission of Inquiry that investigated the circumstances leading to the arrest of the former Army Commander, Lieutenant General Mahau, and the funding and the recommendations of that commission. And then, of course, with the latest development and the way forward. That's basically the structure of our presentation, honourable members of Parliament. As a way of background, honourable members, you would be aware, you recall that Lesotho, we don't want to go back to history that much, but we just want to locate our presentation from beginning 2014 up to date. Beginning of 2014, there were elections in Lesotho. And those elections were resulted in a coalition led by former Prime Minister Tom Tshabane. Right at the beginning of the coalition, there were tensions quite clearly in that coalition as it relates to allegations of fraud involving senior party members, or coalition party members. And then the situation got complicated now with the first coup attempt of August 2014. And of course, in the Lesotho, other members will be aware that there is an inherent tension between the Lesotho Defense Force, and the Lesotho Marine Police Service. This is as a result of unclear roles and money of the two institutions. Then SADC had to intervene after that failed coup attempt of August 2014. In that intervention in September of that year, Deputy President Ramaphosa gets appointed the SADC facilitator because the feeling was that you needed a person senior from the region who was going to assist the social to deal with his own challenges. Between September of 2014 and December of that year, the President Ramaphosa then assisted Lesotho at the time to prepare for the election. Because the feeling was that the coalition government that existed at the time was not working. So a decision was taken by the people of Lesotho, the leaders there, that they needed to go for elections. And those elections then were held in February 2015. And all observer missions that were deployed, the honorable members, and the observers that we're talking to here are the SADC election observer mission, the AU observer mission. Those two observer missions declared elections in Lesotho as being peaceful, transparent, credible, free and fair, and thus reflecting the will of the people of the kingdom. Those, if you look at those statements, they cut at those key concepts. Now, in those elections of March of February, there was not a winner, and therefore it was forced again to form a coalition government. A coalition government was then formed between All Basotho Convention. It was formed between the DC, the Democratic Congress, and Prime Minister Mosibidi, as well as the LCD, the Lesotho Congress for Democracy, which is led by Mbeki, the current Deputy Prime Minister. Just to backtrack a bit, you will remember, you'll be aware that the coalition of former Prime Minister Tom Tabane included ADC, which is Tom Tabane's party, as well as LCD, which at the time was led by Mbeki, who at the time was the Deputy Prime Minister. So Mbeki was the Deputy Prime Minister of Tom Tabane, and then after the elections of February 2015, he then became Deputy Prime Minister under Dr. Mosisi. So that's the coalition that you have, and it includes other smaller political parties. In Parliament, they have about 150. This coalition has got 65 in total. The ABC of Tom Tabane and the Basotho National Party, together with one or two other parties, they have 55 seats. So the difference between the majority and the opposition party is only 10 seats, you will see that, honorable member. It's very important to underscore this one. This coalition under Mosisi, they signed an agreement when they formed this coalition. And that agreement set out what they needed to do during this period. And what they needed to do was to implement the recommendations of the SADC regarding the constitutional and security set reform. Now, we move on to what we then call return of instability to the Lesotho. As we said earlier on, when the Lesotho went to the polls, and the manner the polls were conducted, and the environment that obtained soon after the election, we had thought that instability had returned to the Lesotho. But soon after that, around about April, quite a number of soldiers were arrested on allegations of being involved in a mutiny plot. Now, this is April 2015. just around the same period, just before the arrest started, the Prime Minister, current Prime Minister, reappointed Lieutenant General Kamodi. Lieutenant General Kamodi was removed as Army Commander by Tom Tabane soon after the coup attempt of August 2014. And then Mahau, the late Mahau, Lieutenant General Mahau, was then appointed. But of importance here, Lieutenant General Kamodi, when he was relieved of his duty, he refused to receive the letter that was firing him. So all he did was to stay in the barrack, so in the barrack of Lesotho. Until that time, then, Deputy President Ramaphosa facilitated their exit. The decision taken at the time, between September and December of 2014, was that the heads of both Mahau and Kamodi must be out of the country to allow the country to prepare for the election. So as the then acting commissioner of the National Police. So the three heads left the school for a while, and Kamodi was in South Africa. He was meant to have gone to Uganda or Sudan, but he didn't. He remained in South Africa. So soon after the election, so he went back to the school and was reappointed. Mahau had gone to Algeria, and then came back after the election and stayed at his residence. So the reappointment of Kamodi after the election of last year, in a way, complicated the situation. That's when we started to get the stories about alleged mutiny at the arrest of the people. At the same time, Tom Tabane, former Prime Minister, fled the country to South Africa together with two opposition party leaders, namely former Minister Masile Bane and Ms. Keke Toranzo. They are still in South Africa. They arrived in South Africa around about May. They are still here in South Africa. And together with a group of soldiers, estimated to be around 50, and some police officers, all of those ran away from to because they hear that they were going to be arrested. Then an unfortunate incident happened on the 25th of June, 2015. Lieutenant General Mahau is killed, allegedly because he resisted an arrest that was effected by a group of army soldiers. And then that caused now a bit of incredible discomfort in the region. President Zuma at the time was the chair of the organ, the special and ministerial fact-finding mission, consisting of a minister from South Africa, a minister from Zimbabwe, and a minister from Namibia. He came back and prepared the report. President Zuma then convened a WTOIKA summit on the 3rd of July. And that WTOIKA summit received the report of Deputy President Ramaphosa. Remember, Deputy President Ramaphosa was a facilitator. He prepared the report. So on the 3rd of July, then he presented his report with his recommendation. The summit endorses his report. And then the report makes key recommendations that the government of Lesotho needs to undertake constitutional security and the public sector reform. That's what the report said. On the same day, the summit decides to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate the circumstances surrounding the death of Lieutenant General Mahau. This was pursuant to the visit of the fact-finding mission, as well as a letter that came from Dr. Musisi, the Prime Minister, requesting specifically SADC to send a commission of inquiry. The same SADC then adopts and approves the terms of reference for that commission of inquiry, and then the composition of that is put together. The commission of inquiry is led by a judge from Botswana, consisting of military, legal, as well as police experts. So they went to Lesotho. What then happened when they arrived there, the government of Lesotho gazetted the terms of reference that were different from the terms of reference that had been approved by SADC. and for the information of the of this committee, the Prime Minister of the Sud, who was present at that summit, so he was aware that the summit had approved the term of reference. So what was required of him and his government was to get ready those terms of reference as they were. So you got that different one, so there was a bit of a statement. So the border commission required that is on the count. We started approved terms of reference, and the government got a different terms of reference. The question now was which terms of reference should the commission of inquiry proceed. So there was a statement now between between beginning July up until August, when we had the summit in Gaborone in 2015. It was at that summit in Gaborone that then the terms of reference, as approved on the 3rd of July, were sort of again, I don't want to say re-approved, but again, there was nothing lost. So the Prime Minister was then urged to go back to Lesotho and convert them as they were. Indeed, that's what happened. He went back and converted them as they were, and the commission inquired and proceeded. But it was already around late. But he proceeded and finalized its work around about early November. Now, during the sittings of the commission of inquiry, many people were invited, including the prime minister, some ministers, some army officers were invited, including the army commander himself, the current army commander, 11th General Amoti. But what was clear during those proceedings was that the army members were not prepared to answer questions. Because by that time, a court martial had been instituted by the Minister of Defense Lesotho under the Lesotho Defense Act to investigate the alleged mutiny. So then the soldiers that presented themselves before the Commission of Inquiry did not want to share information because they were then saying that the matter was before the court martial. Soon after that, then Lieutenant Colonel lays a case before the court of Lesotho declaring that, offering to declare the Commission of Inquiry as being null and void and illegal. And the Lieutenant Hasisi is the one who said to have led the group of soldiers that went to, that set up to arrest Lieutenant General Mahao. Cited in that case was the Sergeant Commission of Inquiry, the Prime Minister and the Attorney General. Strange enough, the Prime Minister and the Attorney General decided not to defend themselves in that court. So the only people that decided, put together a legal team to defend themselves was the Sergeant Commission of Inquiry. Now, it was clear, the honourable members, that was a clear attempt by the powers that be, particularly the army, to collapse the Commission of Inquiry. Because the court decided that it was probably null and void, so there would not have been a need to have a Commission of Inquiry. It would have been a waste of money, $4 million, and time of those people. But early December, then when we realized that was the situation, we then facilitated the holding of a summit to receive the report of the Commission of Inquiry. It was received on the 5th of December in Johannesburg. And then we then facilitated that a double track summit again gets convened. It's convened on the 18th of January in Gaborone. And main reason was to receive the report of the Commission of Inquiry. Now we've got about six member states that are there, so the double troika. They received the report of the Commission of Inquiry. Now, if I can just take through the members on the findings of the Commission of Inquiry. Honourable members will be aware the Commission of Inquiry was set out to investigate the circumstances leading to the death of Lieutenant General Mahao. Now, the key findings of the Commission of Inquiry One were to say that a conclusive finding on whether there was mutiny or not could not be found. That those soldiers who appeared before the Commission of Inquiry did not say much about the mutiny plot on the grounds that the matter was subjudicated before the court matter. The Commission of Inquiry then established that suspects of the mutiny were tortured with a view to have them confess mutiny and implicate others. The Commission therefore concludes that the alleged mutiny might have been a fabrication. It then goes on to say that the SDF soldiers that went to arrest Mahau did not observe the required procedure. One, that after Mahau, they said that Focus went to arrest Mahau. He was driving from his farm, not just outside the Maseru. Four cars went to arrest him. The third car goes in front, blocks his car. Second car comes on the side of the driver. The two cars at the back. Then the soldiers from the cars come out. By that time, Howard stopped. In the car is Mahau plus the sons of his uncle. The soldiers from the car come out and open fire on him. The two sons manage to escape. Mahau opens the door and then he fell. Then they pull him on the ground and they put him at the back of one of the cars. They shot him several times. AK-47 machine gun. Now they take him to hospital, the military barracks. They take him to a military barracks. The family hears about this because the boys went to report it. The family attempts to go and see him and they are denied entry for over 2 hours. They approach a lawyer. Late that day on the 25th, then finally they given access to. And then the Commission of Inquiry then found that first, the body of Mahau was washed. His clothes were washed. DNA to destroy evidence. The government position or the army position in this regard is that on that day, this group of soldiers set out to arrest him, stop him, and he told him that they were arresting him, and then he pulled out a pistol and pointed the pistol at the soldiers. That's why they shot him. Another finding by the Commission of Inquiry was that, remember, one of the allegations was that they were politically motivated killings. They couldn't find any evidence in that regard. So, the recommendations then of the, and then the Commission of Inquiry concludes that Mahau did not resist arrest. Even if he did, he did not he did not pose any danger to the soldiers, to the rest of the soldiers, to warrant the kind of response that was meted out to him. That's what Commission of Inquiry said. Then the recommendation of Commission of Inquiry are as follows. One, that on the balance of probabilities, the evidence shows that the late Mahau did not resist arrest. That the force used was not considered to the danger he posed with his pistol. That the proper preservation of evidence was not done as I said, the washing of his body, clothes, vehicles, and firearms. And then it makes the following recommendation. It makes the following recommendation. The soldier that were involved in killing of Mahal must be investigated by the Lesotho police. Two, that 11th General Kamoti must relieve of his duty. Three, that the Lesotho must then undertake the required constitutional statutory reforms. Four, that the SADC must deploy what is called oversight committee. Those are the recommendations then of the Commission of Inquiry. And then, as I said, on the 18th of January this year, this report was handed over to the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister of Lesotho was then requested to go back and implement the recommendation of the Commission of Inquiry and report to SADC, and also implement the recommendations of the SADC facilitator, as I said, on Deputy President Maposa. Now, the recent development opposed to the SADC summit of 16 January, the Prime Minister of Lesotho tabled before his parliament the report of the Commission of Inquiry. The opposition parties then staged a walkout in response to what they believed to have been to a report that they believed was doctored, because in the report, in the composite report, the names in the report that was presented to parliament, the names of the alleged perpetrators were removed. So the opposition parties then, in response to that, they take this walkout. Now, what is expected then of the two honorable members? Just now, I was about to conclude on this. One is that the suit is expected to implement the recommendation of the SADC Commission of Inquiry in totality. That's the situation. And the suit will get the report at the next summit in August. Second, the Lesotho is expected, therefore, to implement the recommendation of the SADC facilitator's report, Deputy President Ramaphosa, as they relate to the constitutional and the security sector reform. Thirdly, Deputy President Ramaphosa continues to perform his responsibility as a SADC facilitator to assist the people of Lesotho to achieve peace, stability in the country. At the bilateral level, honorable members, because Lesotho is inside South Africa, we have got an interest as a country to ensure that Lesotho is stable. We have got what we call the Joint Bilateral Commission on Cooperation, whose main objective is to promote political, economic, and social cooperation between the two nations. And now we are wanting to engage them to implement all the identified key projects, including the Highland Water Project. Highland Water Project, honorable members, is very critical to us because particularly phase two of that project will provide us with additional volumes of water for our country that is now water scarce. And then we continue then at the bilateral level to avail ourselves to assist the people of Lesotho to achieve peace and stability. But that to conclude, it remains a challenge that the leadership of the opposition is not in Lesotho, it is still in South Africa. And Lesotho need to work towards returning them back to Lesotho as decided by SADC. And the Prime Minister has to provide the required support and security to former Prime Minister Tom Tabane. That's what we expect. And the good President Maposa is ready then to assist in the regard. All the members, this is then our report on this suit. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, DDD, for a very detailed and comprehensive presentation. And if I may recommend to ourselves here, we should take discussions on Lesotho separately and then on Burundi separately. We can get both presentations, but when we discuss, we will not have a train that inputs and responses. That's the recommendation I'm making. But I also want to request people who are not always in our committee at least to introduce themselves to the members here. Yeah? I'm in the chair, and the reason why also is because I made a joke here, and one of the members actually said, "Chair, you are on record, withdraw," and I did withdraw. Now, people who are not used to me sometimes, and as a presiding chair here, may think that indeed one of the things we want from this department is the recommendation that I spoke about the country in question. And that's not the position of a country. So I could be misconstrued on that. But also, having welcomed you, let's start with the people who are whispering there. They're whispering in the chat, but they're also whispering in the office.
Oh, I'm Abel Buting from Parliamentary Communications. Okay, I'm Abel Buting from Parliamentary Communications Services.
Thank you.
Ismail Hussain from PNG. I'm usual in the committee.
Kosha Bodhi Chagwanesh from Public Education Office. Parliament.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Morgan Pule. I'm also from the Public Education Office, Parliament of South Africa.
Good morning, sir. My name is Arthur Link. I'm the Ambassador of Israel to South Africa.
Oh, thank you. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. My name is Tariq Mudurima. I'm from Burundi. I represent opposition of Burundi.
Oh, thank you very much. Welcome.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Leonidas Ndagije. I represent the opposition of Burundi.
Thank you very much. Welcome, most welcome.
My name is Charles Ngaire. I am Vice President of the UPD, the Amiwanga Opposition Party in Burundi, here in South Africa.
Thank you very much,
and
welcome.
My name is David Kernhoffen. I'm from New Age.
New Age? You know, please look and remind me of the Cuban Week.
It's like that.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very pleasant. Yeah. But follow up. Okay, thank you very much, honorable members. Over to you for any comment. Anything you want.
All right, first of all, I'd like to welcome the address by DDG. But this address has got a lot of troubling elements, of which I think that as a country we must really focus on them. Because we cannot be doing the same thing many times and expect the different results when the condition is the same. So the first question I'd like to ask here, what is the support of the SADC intervention with the Bureau of Lesotho in general? Apart from the capacities, I think that must have gauged the posturing of the population of Lesotho. What is it, even though, is it receptive to the subject integration or not? And then number two, Chair, what is also disturbing? What is the issue of the defiance. I think that the continuous defiance of the subject led of mission that led. Take example, both the generals were moved, and then when they went back, they go back with the permission of SADC or not. Mahau and Kamu didn't have did they go back with the permission of SADC? And then number two, as with the recommendation of the Deputy President, Sir Ramaphosa, how far are they with that implementation? How far are they with that implementation? And then number four, the issue of the oversight committee. Who composed of that as oversight committee? What is his mandate? Is this recommendation binding or not? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Adele. Honorable Mokalapa.
Thank you very much, sir. Let me also take this opportunity to welcome the presentation. Definitely agree with Honorable Adele. I think that there's quite a lot of concern regarding this situation, and my worry is if nothing is done differently, definitely in the next 4 years we will be going back there for another intervention. There are many loopholes here that are here in terms of the issues that happen there. The first question is, when the soldiers went to arrest the deceased Brigadier Mahau, did they have a warrant of arrest? And I think the question that came in the Commission of Inquiry is, who authorized the arrest? Because it's quite absurd that a colonel in an army can be the one who can just go and institute this arrest without the defense chief knowing and the prime minister knowing about this thing, you know, but it just doesn't make sense. The second one is on the issue of the 15 army officers and opposition who are here in South Africa. Are they put in a safety place? Is defense or state security or police involved in their security? Who is handling them here in South Africa? Or are they just walking freely in South Africa? I know the details of where they are for their own safety cannot be resolved, but is someone handling them? Do we know where they are, what they are doing, their movements, and all those kind of things? Because we just can't have the situation that is going on like that. Then on the recommendations, let me just also ask this one. Because the opposition state walked out when the Prime Minister was presenting the report, because he edited some of the contents of the report, especially the perpetrators who were edited on the list. Did those perpetrators have been subjected to the Commission of Inquiry? Were the recommendations for them individually to face criminal charges? I know in overall the commission recommended that there must be criminal charges laid, but the bone of contention is on those list of those perpetrators who were entered by the Prime Minister. What is their status in terms of it? Because if these things are not addressed, certainly another coup or mutiny or anything is coming, because of all the stakeholders are still out there. And I agree with Honorable Hader in terms of the return of both brigadiers. Who sanctioned that? Because of, I don't think that in a security situation like that, they can just return by their own self. So someone must have sanctioned it. SADC or the SOTU or themselves. So it's more than what meets the eye here. Because of in a security situation, you take care of every detail. Nothing is taken for granted. Because of it's about people's life. Thank you very much, Chair. Let me consider.
I like that question. There's more than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Babum Bumlwana.
I really sympathize with your department as far as this is concerned. It seems that you are milking a bull.
they're doing a good job there, but as far as little bit concerned. You see, that conflict is very old. And very, very old. It started in 1965. It's between certain people who were literally, it has got something to do with the church, it belongs to a particular denomination, it is complicated. Secondly, because of that, there is also something involved with that. I'm not sure if you see check the question of the relationship between Kamut and Prime Minister. And something that involves tenders. I don't know whether you check that. But anyway, let me just say you've done a good job in the circumstances. I think strictly speaking, the only solution would be people to be persuaded to those who want. If I had my way, I would allow them to remember the celebration. What?
Thank you very much. Now, for the responses, if I can just add on the good comments that have been made by my colleagues. Does the Commission of Inquiry recommend something around the fate of the soldiers who are alleged mutineers? I think the observation was that he found guilty, they will face a penalty according to the constitution of Lesotho. Now, if, for instance, for now they are conscious, does this commission say something around that? And whether it has authority, this commission of Judge Justice Kumar, to make a recommendation around that, and the extent to which it could be binding. As they added, there was Polka mandate, because you see, even that it affects the security services of a particular country, particularly defense in this system. Now, it's an important thing given that you have correctly indicated that the trouble has always been the problem, the weakness is the constitution and the involvement of the security forces. Now, who was involved? I don't think it was a part of the attempt of reference of Judge Kumar. Who has been involved in the attempted coup of 2014? It was General Kamudi, as I suspect. And then it is then the reason why the Prime Minister then later removed him and put Brigadier Mahau. And it is the reason why then when he came back, he felt that this one took my job. And he might have engineered the thing. So, what have they done about it? And then the last one around that one is whether I think it's unfair to put it to you to ask you, but I will ask it anyway, whether the political leadership of Lesotho is aware that what conflicts them perennially always brings challenges is the way the constitution is crafted. And secondly, the security establishment. First, that the constitution allows for a coalition, and the coalition is very tenuous. Whoever is in charge, if you look at the previous election, not this one, it's got 40.99%, the other one 40.something%, then arrangement, only prime minister, then the deputy prime minister migrates with his seat or her seat to the other party, then there must be a new arrangement and the constitution is suspended, we've got a problem. So, that arrangement, I'm not sure if they can learn from other experiences. The question is whether the political leadership of parties themselves are committed to changing that constitution, as Honorable Mumlwana was saying, the problem is as old as 1965. Because it could be coming from there. So you may need to amend the constitution. The other one is the interference stroke intervention of the security services. So I think the constitution must just clearly put them in their place. So that they subject themselves in terms of the constitution. First, they must, when taking an oath of office, acknowledge the supremacy of the constitution of the country. So that whichever party is in charge, they must uphold the constitution. So that it's not the soldiers themselves who violate the constitution, then they want to unseat a sitting government, an elected government, I wanted to say. Now whether the constitution is moving in that direction. But I think you can answer to the extent that you can. But at this point, I think as members ourselves, we may also need to be guided about this politically by the minister and beyond that. But we also needed to recommend the intervention and facilitation that our deputy president has made so far on behalf of SADC. Because as we all know, Lesotho is very strategic for South Africa from both the point of view of security, but from an economic point of view, because 30% of our waters come from there. So a policy respect for our own economic survival. Back to you in the absence of further comments, Honorable Kenya.
That's what. On the issue of this conflict of defense forces and police, resulting in the unclear roles mandate, is there any recommendation that I want to separate the roles so that the conflict is not due to that? And also, on the issue of the oversight committee, I think before the roadmap, my understanding, the roadmap brings one as a recommendation. Is there a clear direction that this committee tried to activate, to engage the stakeholders? Because it will be just an ongoing process. Coalition. If stakeholders there are not engaged in the situation, so that even when the roadmap is drawn, they are within the parameters of the
And in your view, could it be that the Prime Minister was at fault in presenting the recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry and then to Parliament, and then omitting the names of those who were involved, and or whether legally he could have done that, but then he had to remove his name. I don't know what the recommendation was going to say, whether when presenting this to Parliament, those names as determined by the recommendation. But you see, when they walked out like this, it creates a stalemate again at a political level and at a parliamentary level. If you look at their history, where the Prime Minister from Tabane suspended the constitution. If you have a stalemate like this, which may have happened at the behest of the Prime Minister, who does not want to reveal his name, he may suspend the constitution. Same thing. It's a different person, but has the same thing. If you can just offer a view around that. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. We start with Honourable Khatib. The first question was about whether, in general, the people of the school should support that intervention. Indeed, there is an overwhelming support for that intervention in the school. You meet with the civil society, with broadly speaking, churches, people, students, organized labor, all of them, when you meet with them, the ones that they should be present there. So there is that support. In fact, to be frank with you, they are now disappointed that as we speak, this oversight committee that was decided upon by SADC on the 3rd of July last year has not been deployed. Remember the issue, the person said the issue of the oversight committee. It was the summit of the 3rd of July in Pretoria that decided to, following the presentation of the report by the SADC facilitator, and that report had clear recommendations about what needed to be done in the group. And then the summit then resolved to establish an oversight committee that would then serve as an early warning mechanism in the Sotho, that's one. Two, that will also then be defeat the required constitutional and statutory reforms in Sotho. As we speak, honorable members, we have, we have not been able to deploy that oversight committee. So there's a bit of a vacuum. And that vacuum is only being, it is filled by the GP, his capacity as a facilitator. But you can't have GP camping in Maseru to deal with it. You need people to be on the ground in the Sotho from SADC member states to assist. So that's the first point. The return of Mahao and Kamoti. Honorable Khadere, I think other members also then made reference to that, whether that was done with a permission from SADC. They are a sovereign state. They would not have required a permission from SADC. But the understanding that SADC had was that whoever won the election in February 2015 was going to be sensitive to a determination that had been made that these three, namely Kamoti and Mahao and the former acting police commissioner, should not, preferably not be returned to their position. But we knew, we need to be frank with you again, we knew that if Dr. Tom Tabane had been re-elected as the Prime Minister, Mahao was going to be returned as Army Commander. So we knew that. So we equally knew that if Dr. Motsoaledi were to become a Prime Minister, which indeed happened, Kamoti was going to return. It's exactly what happened. But what we didn't know was the reappointment of Kamoti was going to create this serious problem for the Sotho that led to the killing of a senior army general. That we did not anticipate. And the Commission of Inquiry itself on this one is very clear on the members. It then says, which I can just read it out for you. It says the appointment of Mahao as Army Commander in August 2014 was legal, and that the removal of Kamoti, this is now by Tom Tabane, the removal of Kamoti at the time was also legal. It then goes on to say that the removal and the demotion of Brigadier Mahao by the current cabinet was legal, meaning therefore that Prime Minister reserved the right to change the, you see. However, the manner it was done was flawed. Now this is a complex word here, flawed, because they don't expand how, what, they don't explain this word flawed, so they leave it hanging like that. And they go to say that the reappointment of Kamoti as Army Commander by the current Prime Minister was legal, but the manner it was done was flawed. That's the Commission of Inquiry saying that. Now, Your third point on Abdul was about the implementation of the SADC recommendations. It's exactly the understanding that we have that the Sotho's problems, they all revolve around the constitution and the majority.
then subject then made a determined effort to once and for all help Lesotho to deal with this pending problem. It was that reason, therefore, that the President Ramaphosa recommended that the government of Lesotho must conduct or undertake constitutional reforms. That is, would then address a number of issues, including the issue of floor crossing and so on and so on. And the issue of the mixed member, the application of the mixed member proportional representation. Now, on the issue of security, it is understood that one of the challenges here is that the army in Lesotho believes that they've got the right to arrest. It's not only the police have got the right to arrest, the army has got to arrest people and investigate and do everything. And then by so doing, that understanding, then obviously then conflict or is exalient what your normal police force should be doing. And that's why then the recommendation is that you need to have a security sector reform. That security sector reform would have to do a number of things. One, there has to be a discussion in the suit whether the suit requires such a big army, which is bigger than the police force. And then two, of course, explain the rules. Who's has got the right to investigate and do what? So that's a discussion that the Sotho has been to do. So as part of we expect the government of the Sotho to seriously undertake this reform, because it is wrong. As Honorable was saying, we'll always be discussing this issue. An issue that started as far back as 1965. Now, the Oversight Committee has spoken to that. We have yet to deploy that. The Oversight Committee has got four key elements. One is got the political segment. It's got the security segment. That would then include police, defense, and security or intelligence. It's also got the legal. The legal in this regard would have to deal with the issues of, I mean, to assist with regard to constitutional and security sector reform. And then the last part is administrative, because part of what you need to do in Lesotho is also try to reform the public service in Lesotho. There are two political lines, and that is the problem. So that's the composition. And South Africa, the composition has been determined. South Africa will have one or two members at all. But what is required now is the Secretariat facilitating their deployment as soon as possible. Let's go to the question by Honorable Mukarabo.
Mukalapa.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Now, the question was whether the soldiers that set out to arrest Mahau were authorized. It is clear that they were authorized. As I said earlier on, remember the arrest of the soldiers suspected to be involved in the mutiny started as early as April. So it was now only towards the end of June that the team went to now arrest Mahau. So it was duly authorized by the relevant authorities in the Sotho. It's a team that has been set up to investigate this alleged mutiny. And then, of course, this level carrying out the eagle leader is the commander of that unit. Now, soldiers in opposition in South Africa, they are big monitors. We can only talk there. They are big monitors. Our security establishment, other institutions are monitoring them. The argument by the Prime Minister to edit the list of the soldiers in the main report is that his argument is that because they have not been charged, so you wouldn't then want to present it publicly. It's still a report, so they would probably their names would only be released when the police investigate the matter. That's his argument. Now, whether that is, you agree with that, but that's what he's saying. For us as Sadiq, we expect that the Prime Minister or the Reverend Minister in the Sutu will then request the police to investigate those that killed the Mahal. I've already responded to the return of Kamoji and Mahal. Now, the relations between the Prime Minister and Kamoji. You remember that Kamoji was appointed by Musisi during his tenure in office. That was before 2014. So he's an appointee by the Prime Minister. But when the former Prime Minister came into office, so right at the beginning, they have said there were tensions between him and Kamoji. And that resulted in that coup attempt of 2014. Now, we are not in a position then to express an opinion on whether that relationship is informed by issues of tenders and so on. You will understand that we would want to express an opinion on that. Chair, the fate of the soldiers, the detained soldiers, there is a court order in this room that demanded that these detained soldiers must be released. And the Prime Minister and his government has not complied with that. So there's a court order by a court of the Sutu, by a judge, that the detained soldiers must be released. Now, their fate depends on the court martial. The court martial has been postponed indefinitely. Now, your second point was about the findings, whether of the commission of inquiry, whether the findings on the suit. In our considered view that they are, because the commission of inquiry was duly established in terms of the subject and protocol, and it enjoys immunity and everything, and therefore whoever requested it must then comply with this recommendation. It's expecting of Sade that the Prime Minister will implement those findings and recommendations. Now the question: who are involved in the coup d'état? It's quite clear. We referred to the tension that existed between the former Prime Minister and the General Kamoji. So, and remember on the day, on the 29th of August, the night of the 29th of August, there were shootings in Maseno. And those shootings were directed at the residence of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister got wind of what was going to happen, and he fled. He fled on the late 28th. Into South Africa. So by the time this attempted coup happened, he was no longer in the suit. So it's clear then you are left then to make some discussions of what had happened. Who was involved in that? Now, your second question, whether the leaders in the suit understand the root cause of the problem. They do. As I said, the agreement that was signed by the current Prime Minister and his coalition partners soon after his re-election last year. It's around the implementation of the constitutional and security sector reform. Because they do. Not only that, SADC in four summits in 20, it started, it was on the 20th of February last year. SADC urged the government of Lesotho to undertake constitutional and security sector reform. The same decision was then repeated on the 3rd of July 2015. The same decision was then reaffirmed in August of 2015. The same decision was further reaffirmed on the 16th of January this year. So that again, various studies has taken the same decision that the government of the Sotho must undertake this constitutional reform. Now, we have already spoken with the issue of interference of the police and the army and so on and so on. It's quite clear that the army needs to regard itself as a key stakeholder in that country, and have done that over the years. That's why then we need to clear the roles between the police and the army. Was the Prime Minister at fault to present a version? I've already spoken to that. I think in a nutshell, honourable members, on the Sotho, to us as SADC, we expect, we are repeating ourselves here, we expect the government of the Sotho to implement the recommendations of David President Ramaphosa, to implement the recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry. And SADC remains ready to assist them to do all those kinds of things. And they have to report in August, this coming August, in Mbabane, when SADC meets. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and welcome Honorable Douglas and Honorable Maila. Honorable Bumluana. Welcome, Tom Tala. Thank you very much for the presentation. What is clear would be, we must, on an ongoing basis, SADC must continue to monitor the people and assist them. There's a person they must also assist the people with. The current deputy prime minister, just pressing with you, because he was a deputy prime minister when Tom Cavanaugh was there, and when he changed allegiance, there was instability. Now he's a deputy prime minister. If Kamodi must be out where he is, and he goes to him for political sanctuary, if I should say so, and he agrees with Kamodi, that Mutezwa thing I'm talking about here, the Mutezwa will be in trouble. Because he will move with his feet to the other person, and that means Mutezwa must go. So, interesting. Very interesting.
Oh, you want to
come back?
Sheraton, I really appreciate the work done by the Deputy President, Cyril Ramaphosa, plus the Department of IR and SADC in particular concerning this news. But I think what is troubling, Sheraton, is the issue of the government which defines the court of law. I feel like we don't have a government there. Because we cannot have a court. You know, the courts are supposed to be a final arbitration. Would have between the disputes between the individuals and institutions. But if that government cannot listen to the court of law, really, I think there's something wrong. I think now the SADC itself, if necessary, must strengthen these issues now. It must be more hard. Because we cannot be talking the same thing year after year. We cannot be doing that. So, but I think that this issue of this defiance of the court, this is well, the court of law, FTC has said that it's truly the sovereign state. But once entered the state, the court must rule. Once they make rulings, those rulings must be respected. Otherwise, it means that there's no court. It means that if the government defies, it means that everyone can defy. So, I don't think that we are having a state then, it is like that. We are not having government then. So I think that the other side of this thing, I think we put a question to the Deputy President. No, we cannot allow this thing to go on. No, we cannot, because you know, our Koko will have a lot of suit. They cannot be treated like this.
You want to have a second bite? Because the night of the long night is not the same.
I don't know. I think more investigation needs to be done. You may be treating the symptoms, and it will take a long time. You will not have it. The army has been in charge, literally, except during the time of the Abua from 1972.
it was under control. But in 1981, it's better to the old. So it's not going to change. It's not going to change at all. I mean, there are things that can be done to solve the situation. But you expect the army to obey the court, you know, the plan. Thank you.
Okay, DTG, thank you very much. Over to you again on the security, the political situation in Burundi. Are you mounting a presentation? Okay.
Thank you very much, honored the chair and the honored members. On Burundi, honored members, we just want to talk to almost 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 issues that we want to do. We just want to list what we believe to be the genesis of the problem, and the security and the stability of the country, the regional intervention, the AU intervention, and the outcomes of the high-level visit of the five heads of state that were there recently, and the expected way forward. And South Africa's rule, which is largely bilateral. We want to start off then, honored members, by recognizing that only prior to a determination that was made for the current president to stand as a candidate, Burundi was very stable in that part of the world. We have fairly open media, democracy, freedom, expression, and association. But when it was announced that President Nkurunziza was going to avail himself for re-election, we started then to have challenges there. Opposition parties rejected his eligibility. And this matter went to the High Court in the land, the Constitutional Court, which declared his candidature as being legitimate. You possess that, then they have elections in July, and President Nkurunziza won by 69% of the polls out of a 70% voter turnout. Most opposition parties boycotted elections. The EAC, the regional body, and the UN, which had sent observers there, declared those elections as being peaceful but not free and fair. The AU did not send observers, election observers. After the election in August, President Nkurunziza then formed a government that includes members, some members of the opposition party. One of them being Mr. Rwasa, who was elected Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly. On the streets of Burundi, then the protests and unrest continued. It degenerated into violence, and the security forces there responded. There was an attempted coup, led by a former chief of military intelligence, General Niyombare, on the 13th of May. This happened at the time the EAC had the summit in Jerusalem.
That summit, that's where we've been invited as a special guest. And I remember our deputy president was among the, that's when this attempted coup happened. Nyarambala has since launched an armed rebel movement in exile within the neighboring state, Rwanda. Soon after that, the president Nkurunziza dismissed 16 ministers and made a main cabinet shuffle, replacement of defense, foreign affairs, and economic development. Continued protests and random attacks on the security forces by unnamed groups and the security forces. Retaliations and handouts in opposition groups. Assassination of high-level leaders of both government and opposition, both Hutu and Tutsi. There was unfortunate killing of an opposition leader, Mr. Zedi Ruzi, on the 23rd of May, and the former head of National Intelligence, political minister advisor to the president and coordinator of the youth wing of the ruling party, Imbonerakure General Chirimana, on the 2nd of August. Another leader was then killed, Ukome Harimana, on the 4th of August. And military strongman, the term strongman, I don't know where it comes from here. And then the military person, Colonel Komung, on the 15th of August. And attempted assassination on the high profile individuals are listed there. And the attempted assassination on the wife of the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, was reported 450 civilians. And the security forces have been killed today. About 230 people reported to have fled the country to the neighboring country. Arrest, detention, alleged human rights violation, torture and disappearance, as well as death continue. Claims of emerging genocide and civil war thus far found it to be unsubstantiated. There is no credible evidence of an emerging genocide or civil war. We continue to have fears of regional spillover of instability and violence to the neighboring countries. The government of Burundi has openly accused Rwanda of recruiting, training, and arming rebels from the refugee camps in Rwanda. Rwanda denies the charges. The economy of the country is in dire state, exacerbated by the withdrawal of donor funds, tax revenues being reduced, government social programs cut back, and the government may struggle to pay civil servants. Regional intervention, as I said earlier on, as a regional body, which in terms of the arrangement within the AU processes, you delegate resolution of a problem to a regional body. EAC has held several summits to address the crisis. As I said, South Africa participated in those summits as invited guests. It was during the EAC summit of 6 July when President Museveni was appointed as mediator for an all-inclusive inter-Burundian dialogue. Since that time, there has not been any demonstrable progress in the dialogue process. The government of Burundi has put conditions on dialogue, including refusal to talk to alleged coup plotters and certain civil society organizations. Opposition parties are divided, but all seek dialogue, including the ones that are in exile. We recognize the colleagues that are here in the house. Agenda for the dialogue, therefore, it would appear is going to be a difficult process for the parties to agree. because the opposition parties that have met over the period, while committing to dialogue, and but they want President Nkurunziza to resign, and that new elections should be held. And the government is not holding the same view. The government appears does not appear to an interim arrangement, and that new election should be held, but open to an inclusive government that would allow the current president to serve out his term. Intervention by the AU. The AU has endorsed Museveni as a mediator for dialogue. The AU initially said agreed to send 100 military and human rights observers to Burundi, but their effectiveness has been hampered by the non-conclusion of an MOU and most importantly, the limited numbers of these military and human rights observers to cover the entire country. It was on the 17th of December last year that the AU Peace and Security decided to deploy a protection and prevention force called MAPUBU of up to 5,000 troops. Requested the Security Council the endorsement. The U.S. Security Council has not endorsed. There's no evidence of impending genocide and civil war has been demonstrated. UN Security in January this year, at the summit level now in Addis, the heads of state therefore decided not to, and this is very important, not to deploy these 5,000 troops to Burundi, but send the high-level delegation to discuss with the government of Burundi and all stakeholders the resumption of an inclusive dialogue under President Museveni. So we want to put it on record that the high-level representative that went to Burundi, their mandate was not to persuade the government of Burundi to accept the 5,000 troops. Their money was clear. They must go there, meet with the stakeholders, and try to hear them out and encourage them to embark on an inclusive dialogue. The high-level representative consists of five heads of state and government: South Africa, Senegal, Gabon, Mauritania, and Ethiopia. President Zuma was requested to lead the delegation, and the delegation went to visit Burundi from 25 to 26 February, the last weekend. The delegation engaged all relevant stakeholders during the visit. In its communique, The delegation expressed concern or condemned all violations of human rights, violence perpetrated against civilians and security forces, expressed concern at the deterioration of the humanitarian situation, and the government and all the armed groups to end violence. First, the need to dismantle and disarm all the militia, called on all the arms groups to lay down their arms and fully participate in the Burundian dialogue, encourage countries and people of the region to refrain from actions that may destabilize Burundi, welcomed the commitment of all the stakeholders that they met to participate without precondition in an inclusive dialogue. And that's very important to underline. The high-level delegation commended the government of Burundi for lifting warrants of arrest against some Burundians
reopening of radio and broadcasting stations, the announcement of the imminent release of detainees under common law, allowing the AU to deploy a further 100 human rights observer groups. In total, the AU is going to deploy 200 people, 100 male observers, as well as 100 human rights observers. The high-level delegation also encouraged the government of Burundi to continue in this direction and consider granting temporary amnesty to all opposition leaders against whom arrest warrants have been issued. It then lastly called upon the international community to restore aid to Burundi in order to encourage participation by all stakeholders in the inclusive dialogue, and to permit development to continue. The AU delegation is going to provide a good report to the chair of the AU, which is the president of Chad, with its recommendation. And inclusive mediation dialogue will start as soon as possible, with the convening of a meeting by President Museveni before the end of March 2016. So we expect therefore that President Museveni will then facilitate the holding of the first session of all the Burundians to discuss their challenges. Now, what South Africa has done, beginning December, a high-level senior officials team went to Burundi. It was led by the Director General of the Department of International Relations, Ambassador Jerry Manchira. Their findings are as follows. One, that violence by unidentified attackers is sporadic, mainly restricted to some parts of Bujumbura. Reports of impending civil war, genocide exaggerated, economy in dire straits, worsened by suspension of donor funding. All stakeholders committed to resumption of dialogue. However, the agenda and objectives differ widely. Need to include the International Commission on the Inter-Burundian Dialogue into the EAC-led mediation. Need to strengthen AU, military observers, human rights observers, and add police observers. That was those were the findings and recommendations of the South African team to our government. Expected way forward by South Africa in particular. South Africa, as one of the guarantors of the Arusha Peace Accord, remains ready to play a part to assist in the peace process in Burundi. Well, South Africa is already playing a part through participation in the EAC meeting and the AU level engagement through peace and security and the regional level representation. South Africa is expected to participate in the AU military observer deployment. South Africa has also agreed to be part of the mediation under President Museveni, pending a formal request. In this regard, the government of Burundi has requested South Africa, so as the current chair of the EAC. And our government has agreed, President Zuma has agreed to be part of that, but pending a formal invitation. We are still awaiting that formal invitation. Now, moving forward, South Africa would have to resuscitate her post-conflict reconstruction and development on Burundi. Remember, as I said, South Africa was one of the countries that facilitated the Arusha process, and we developed what we call PCRD. We trained a few diplomats, but there's a request now on the table for us to continue with the training of the Burundian diplomats. There's also a request for TRC
truth and reconciliation support. Our government is applying its mind on that and see how then do we put together a team of experts that would then assist the people of Burundi with their reconciliation and unity moving forward. We are ready as a government to continue to provide what we call institutional capacity building by training of civil servants and the military and the police. We are required to establish what we call a business council. We've got a very close relations with Burundi, with all the Burundians. We need to foster a close economic cooperation. And therefore, we also have a structured bilateral mechanism called Joint Permanent Commission for cooperation that we need to operationalize. Key in our bilateral engagement, particularly related to economic development, we need to assist, develop, and identify economic projects and infrastructure projects that can be realized to assist Burundi with her developmental agenda. Thank you very much, and this is our presentation.
Thank you very much, DDG, once again, for a very good and detailed presentation on the Republic of Burundi. I see that the hands are already up. Honorable Khatev. Honorable Klapkuti. Okay, yeah. Who are you? Mukalapa, is it you or Dagma? Both? Okay. And then Honorable Dagma, Maylain Tatliki, Mayla. Yeah. There you are, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first observation is the regret which I'm going to express. In particular, that the African Union didn't send in observers during that election. Because I think that it was the edge on their part. I think that it must be said, it must be on record, the edge on their part, because they are supposed to nurse the African continent out of the dark ages of colonialism. So if the Burundians needed them most, they were supposed to be there and guiding them and helping them forward. So by the method that they didn't send any observers on that former side, I think that really, as this committee, we must express a threat around that. And then, but really appreciate again that they are making up for that. They've made up for that. But that was a regret. Why is it regrettable? Because the highest court in Burundi had decided that the candidature of President Nkurunziza was legitimate. So who in the world must come and challenge that? Because people are not going to observe the rule of law. People are not going to observe the rule of law. There's just going to be anarchy. There's going to be anarchy. So I think that the seeds of anarchy were set by the defiance of, by the people who are supposed to be part of that, defying the highest court in the country. Because people are going to defy the court. Who's going to abuse? Who's going to come and abuse between ourselves and our conflict? So I think that that part is set. It must never be repeated again. Everyone must report, must do that. But at the same time, really, I think that it is very unfortunate that our African brothers and sisters are almost at square one, where they were before. Because, you know, from the Berlin Conference in Berlin, in Germany, Africa was subdivided and red on its resources. And then almost more than a century later, the Africans are still suffering. Yeah. It cannot rise. It cannot rise.
Yeah.
So I think that the only people who can lift themselves out of that misery of colonialism are the Africans themselves. And like what the chair said, that I didn't liberate anyone. The people liberated themselves.
Yeah.
The chair, Kwabara, he said, I didn't liberate anyone. The people liberated themselves. So I think it's the high time that we as Africans liberate ourselves from the shackles of colonialism by one respecting institutions which are there to govern us.
Yeah.
So if the court of law has made a determination, it is correct. It was very unfortunate that even the opposition boycotted the election. Because it means that if they boycotted the election, it meant that they didn't recognize the determination of the court. So it means that even when they are in government, if they come into government, are they going to respect the court? Which is very sad. I don't think it's correct. It cannot be pursued like that. Number two, Chair, when the issue of the voter turnout was 70%, it was 70%, the voter turnout is one of the high voter turnout we come across. I recall in local government in 2011 in South Africa, the voter turnout was 65%. It was 65%. And all those results of those elections were legit. So if it is 70% voter turnout, and then the president gets how much? 68%. So it means that the legitimate president, there's no one who can go and contest that president. That's why even the opposition should have used what happened in Senegal. When President Wade, Abdul Wade, wanted to stand for the third term, the opposition went to the hall, they beat him in the hall. They beat him, they didn't run away. They went to the hall and beat him. But in the parable, that's why because the body is no longer present. That's why his son is already in prison because of those things which happened. So what is very important is that, Chair, is the respect of the institutions one trouble? Because South Africans, if you don't respect our court, we are going to be troubled. But what I'm also interested in, Chair, is the issue of who are the people who withdraw the donor funding? Because then, I think that the people of Burundi need the assistance of all the world, of all the people of the world. Yeah. So when we withdraw donor funding, it's not the government is going to suffer. It is the ordinary people on the ground. If the civil servants are not going to be in, it means that they are setting the country up for failure. You want to have a failed state. Once you have a failed state, you are going to have conflict. So whoever has withdrawn that donor funding does not have the interest of the Burundians at heart. But I really appreciate the South African government by helping the Burundians. Definitely. We need to have the business culture there. They must be trained so that the country can be economically viable. Because when the country's economy is not vibrant, the people have nothing to lose. They can go, but once they have property, once they have money in the bank, I'm telling you, Chair, they're not going to allow any anarchy to. Even in South Africa, they try to do that. But the people of Burundi, hey, no, our interests are at stake here. Yeah. So I think that I really appreciate what the South African government has done, but I want to know, who are these donors who have withdrawn that? And that's all the issue of the destabilization of Burundi by neighboring countries, really. Rwanda is getting me worried. We supported them as a country in 1994. South Africa supported Rwanda through and through so that it could be achieved with itself. Yeah. But it is disturbing if it is claimed, I don't say it is that, if it is claimed that it is training a rebel of Burundi, then there's a serious problem. That thing must be attended. Because that claim is not only coming from Burundi. Also the side of DRC, the same claim is coming about Rwanda. I think that there must be a special engagement with the government of Rwanda at the EU level. So that because we cannot have similar claims from different countries, and then there's nothing to do that. Really, but I really appreciate that. Our brothers and sisters in Burundi must work together and ensure that they've got viable government. There must be no preconditions. Because here in South Africa, we also had apartheid. Our grandfathers were murdered. I'm from the Kubi tribe. In the Kubi tribe, our grandparents were raped by the colonial police. But for the sake of taking the country forward, even though we will absorb those things. Let's help people move forward for the sake of the country. Yeah. So, but I think all the Burundians really must work hand in hand because there's no one going to listen out of this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honorable Rapport.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Matanya. Yeah,
I'm taking a chief from my week here. I really recommend the work that South Africa is playing, you know, in keeping peace in Rwanda. You know, what South Africa has identified, they have identified that there is sporadic kind of, you know, of rebels and some conflict in Bujumbura. On my view, I believe that they must track this and really deal with it, with those anarchists in there. That is my view, because it's really sporadic, and I think that they can be able to maintain this. And then, and on, also on the issue of the, you know, of stakeholders, I understand that there is, they are committed to resumption of a dialogue. However, agenda and objectives are very wide. But I think what they should really put in the census of the Rwandans is this: the constitutional court have ruled out that the ruling is that their president is not the third term, it's the second term. Because now the rebels are running with the wrong kind of, you know, information, which really is punishing their country. So, in somehow, I think they must be too direct and just say it as it is. And if really they don't respect the code of law, then there's something that is a big question mark. So that is, if ever really there are people who are, they're going past there in Bujumbura and deal with these rebels. Because we can see that there are that kind of tendencies here in South Africa. And just deal with them, just let us, and throw them out. You know, like weeds. Like weeds, no weeds. They really spoil. So they must go and be uprooted, I think, sure.
Thank you, Honorable Kenya.
Thank you for the presentation. Yes, I'm worried about what you talked about. You talk about the stress need to determine the harm all ministers here. And yes, that is, I'm really having a concern, that comment, because when you look at this conflict, youth is being killed from the ruling party and also from the military. So that is, this can also be a recurring deathmatch. That can also lead to the genocide which happened there if the youth is killed like that. My question is only, I remember on the last, on our last position, there was this UN appointed mediator who resigned to their biasness. Maybe because that's I don't know now. Where they replaced their after? The reason why I'm asking this question is the fact that now the UN Security Council is talking about the deployment of biasness troops. Then also, I'm also glad that we're talking about the meeting with stakeholders, because really, the stakeholders should be included in this dialogue, because they have them who are there on the ground. And even if you call the media there, but you leave them there. If you leave them, and when you leave them, they are not seen eye to eye, that will go back to square one, as it's happening now, as it's happening, as the data said. My question now, because I understand that to my understanding also, the Burundi, the visit to go from Burundi by the president, the visit to Kabanga by the president of Burundi, he also came to understand some of the issues are here, I can understand. He also came that for indirecting force to request South Africa for indirection on the multilateral forum. As you know, that Burundi is contributing a lot with the troops, there are so many troops there. Now, my second question, I'm asking this because I don't see it in the South African rules, or also in the, on the intervention now. It doesn't, I don't see that, because that was also one, as much as they wanted
and peer support, so we get the training of diplomats and senior officers. I understand that you can see them there listed. But now I'm worried about that, because that is also very important that material forum to be taken on board. My other question is that are those troops which now we're talking about, these troops which are to be saved, are they from Amisom? Of those peacekeeping force from Malia? Those are 7 because we're talking about 47, 35,000. My other question has been asked by Beji, and also the issue of President of the Disciples of Christ, because this President really has been cleared of all that.
Thank you very much.
Honorable
Mkumlana? Yes. It seems like it's always easy. This is only very. The problem we're having here, we've got other interests, mainly from outside the country, that are interested in looting and use people, and they try better when they cut it. And of course, it's not only the money from the country, but money from those that who are paid, whoever is in power. That's the problem we're having. Do we have that problem in Peru? Why are these steps the opposition party not going back? And what are the problems regarding they feel unsafe? Is there pathetic that the opposition is literally being eliminated by the government state? Are there any other countries like, what is the involvement in Rwanda? What is involvement of Rwanda? And but mainly I want to say Department of International Relations makes me proud of being a country. I feel good when I look at the TV and I see the minister and the president right through. They are doing a splendid job. I think even if Ademo Kalamba will agree with me on this one, and the president and the president of international relations, they are doing a very good job for the people of South Africa. In the medium color, so that we can have, you will have it.
Definitely. And thank you for the chair.
Thank you. So that those are basically the questions, and I think that please put yourself on the back. You are good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anarum Kalasa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I agree with you on one thing. Maybe it's a question that we need the opposition that's here. Why did they run away from Burundi? Perhaps it will give us a perspective and an opinion from the other side of the equation. And I think since that they are our guests and they are here, we should be allowing them, giving them the space to also have their input and opinion heard. Yeah, I think the important thing here is about the role of the international community, especially their responsibility to protect. Because we cannot be saying there's no sign of genocide or civil war while we've got 450 people dead and we've got 230,000 people displaced. What is that? What does it mean? Do we have to have 1,000 more or 1,000,000 more people to die? And then that is when we say we've got evidence that there is civil war and genocide. And I think what we are doing in Burundi, we are doing the same as what happened in Rwanda, when the international community just put a blind eye. And years later, we got shame in our hands because of we let the situation escalate to where it was. Yes, I acknowledge and note and appreciate what the AU have done with the five high-level panel. But I want to find out what was the decision that led to the AU head of state. And remember, the AU, from a ministerial and ambassador's point of view in December, approved the deployment of the 5,000 peacekeeping mission to Burundi. What convinced the head of state in February to overturn and change that? That is the bold elephant in the room. What convinced the AU heads of state to do that? And yes, the five high level panel went to Burundi. They did not put in time frame. They said as soon as possible, President Museveni must convene an all-inclusive dialogue. And I think that all-inclusive dialogue, does it include those leaders in the diaspora, because of the lots of diaspora leaders here in South Africa, from Burundi, in Brussels, they are there, all over the world. And are the conditions being given that whoever comes back for a dialogue will be safe to come and dialogue? Because if you do an inclusive dialogue, it's precondition, it doesn't have conditions. You got to make it open, you know. And you got to allow everybody to come in. You start it from scratch. And look, I accept the fact, Honorable Hadebe, of rule of law, and that is one thing that we must always agree on. But the challenge is, what happens when you've got the rule of law with a gun on your hand? There is an allegation that a judge ran away from Burundi because of the anomaly of the judgment that was given. So I appoint you as a judge, and you must, and let us not assume that all in Africa is, the judiciary is as robust as and independent as South Africa. Let us for one pause there, because of in some countries it's a matter of life and death and singing for your papa. It's as simple as that. So let us also consider that as well, or give it the benefit of a doubt if we don't have to take it as a fact of life.
Let us
also look at it. So I'm just saying that the inclusivity must ensure that everybody comes there. And someone must take responsibility for the displacement of the people and must take responsibility for the killing of those people that has happened there. And I understand that conflict resolution and peace negotiation is not an event. It's not an overnight thing. It's a process. And that must be taken into context in that way. But those are two sticking points, you know, that I would want the clarity on in terms of, and what will be the role of the 100 military? And I appreciate South Africa's point of saying, let us also include police as well. And that is a good step to take. But what will be their role in terms of the military and as well as the human rights observers that are there, because of there is tangible action that needs to be taken there. There is, and we are talking about the allegations against Rwanda. It's also coming in Rwanda, let us bear in mind. Paul Kagame's term is coming to an end, and already there's been a referendum done that will give him the new way to go again for a third term. What happens if it's reciprocated? Because of that is the reason that is highly sensitive there. So it can easily sprawl to Rwanda, much as there's an allegation that Rwanda is training those rebels. And then, you know, to dismantle rebels is not as easy as it seems. We've learned in the DRC, you know. Those dynamics might be different because of the geography of the area, but it's not as simple as that you go in and flush out. So I would also request the chair through your committee just to give the opposition leaders from Burundi to share some thoughts with us, with your permission, chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable Bachmann.
Thanks, chair. I was going to say in support of what everyone else has been saying in terms of the perceived civil war, or lack thereof, should we say, I often find a problem in how we get to the conclusion. You know, it's almost a sense of whoever went to observe went in there, asked everyone, sorry, are you going to kill so-and-so, or are you going to kill so-and-so? Right, well then there's no civil war, because no one said that they were going to run to wipe up the other side. The indication was, the first indication was at the election. We saw a high turnout, which actually points to either an Australian system where you actually forced to go out and vote, because that's law, or you're forced to go and vote in terms of the situation is so bad that you want to change government. It's very, very rare that in a system where everything's flourishing and everything's working that you'll get a turnout of over 70%. In my own personal, humble opinion, I'm going to suggest very strongly that people are either forced to go and vote for the right people. And the indicator, the check principle in that, is what the observers say. The observers say that the election was peaceful. However, they cannot give an opinion that the election was free and fair. There's no war in the streets, but the observers are not saying that the election was free and fair. So somewhere along the line, the 70% turnout, there's something to look deeper in that only yields a 69% vote for the president. The problem comes in again is where we look at 200,000 opposition members that clearly don't believe that their lives are safe enough to live in a country still, and the 400 people that can't talk today because they're no longer here. There's something more indicative to us that something is not right. And really, so at what stage do we call it a civil war? At what stage do we call it an escalation towards a civil war? And do we only start stepping in more aggressively once it is a civil war? You know, once only some people are just sacrificed, only once a certain number of people sacrifice their lives, then do we call it a civil war? So from our side, I say that we need to be more vigilant on this and have more checks and balances. In fact, there are at this point almost flags in the ground. Take an unemotional decision and say, right, at this point, we're calling out this happened. That's an indicator that we're one step closer to a civil war. This is what must engage. At this flag in the ground, this is indicative that this part of civil war, we step too closer. This must engage. Now, the other problem is, who do we send? Now, South Africa historically has a tendency of being the big brother of the continent. You know, we have our intellectual property always engaged in negotiations, and we have our human capital always engaged in the activity. So it's almost the case as our chief negotiators, our president, our deputy president, they're always running around putting up fires, and then we back it up by sending our own troops. Now, that's double the cost. It costs us intellectually and costs us on manpower. So I would strongly suggest that where we send some of our prime people that are meant to be performing prime functions internally, domestically, that we do not double pay for that. We don't also then send in troops. If we rely on troops nearby, or we rely on the intellectual capital nearby, and we send troops. So either way, it must be a one or the other. It shouldn't be a both. I think we're at a stage now where we're not the only big brothers in Africa. Within the African Union, there are a few big brothers that can also be pulling their weight to ensure that there's enough people monitoring the international side of things, and that we've got enough people monitoring internally. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Maila.
Thanks, President. And thanks to the department for the presentation. Without delivering the point, Mr. President, I would like to touch on the issue of the independence of the judiciary. Generally, nations of the world agree that it is the duty of all governments and other institutions to respect and observe the independence of the judiciary. So, it comes as a surprise that when the decisions of the judiciary have to be respected, then they are questioned and indeed even funds are withheld. It comes as a surprise. Without trying to differ with Honorable Mohalaba, I find it strange that if I appointed a judge and the judge rules in my favor, that judge will then run away from the country. How does it happen? Rwanda is about to go to elections in 2017. President Zahra is likely to enter into a third 7-year term. But, yeah, 7-year term.
Yeah,
but resistance to that is very feeble as compared to what is happening in Burundi. You ask yourself why. So you have hypocrisy at play here. So I think those were my few points. Thank you very much.
The last one, Honorable Darling.
Thank you. I also want to just query around the donor funding. Sort of what are the issues? Do the funds go where they're meant to go? For example, if South Africa is ending donor funding, do we know that funding is getting where it's supposed to go? If that's maybe the issue and it's not just a political sort of strong-arming, what can be done about that, and are we considering what we can do in terms of that? Including the police observers made me jump to remembering where we've had people on the ground who have gone with the idea of a mentality of being peacekeepers and then stuck in the middle of conflict and then lose their lives. So it brings to mind sending police as observers if they're not prepared for, you know, they'll be sitting ducks because they're not actually prepared for what they might actually face. Could be a red rag to a bull kind of situation. And of course that also applies to the military in some sense. If we are trained as military, we've got to go with the mindset that things could escalate to that point and not just be there as the leader. Obviously the peacekeeping missions, what the real problem is, why they're holding back, what's behind what's been said and done. Perhaps there's some very practical issues that we should be aware of. And I missed any introduction of people being here from Burundi, and I would agree that if we do have that privilege, it would be very interesting for us to actually have heard from you today if we had the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mukhalafa, I said I'll come back for a ruling on the matter that you had raised. Be reminded of all the time the decision that the presiding officers in parliament always tell the visitors in the gallery. You remember that sometimes they get carried away if one speaker is saying something there or a particular party is saying something there. And then we either start clapping hands or they start singing or they do certain things. Telling officers always say, you are not allowed to participate. You just sit there and observe. And that rule also applies in the committee. The observers are allowed, journalists, political parties and NGOs and etc. They're allowed to observe in other committees, but they cannot participate. They can participate if and only if a committee invites them. You can invite them as a particular NGO or as a particular party to make a presentation, and or different parties for the same country. And you can say that party and that party and that party, or that church and that church and that church, and hear them out and make a determination. But in this instance, for them, our president is a facilitator already, and but the full-time mediator is going to be the president of Uganda. Now, if we say people who come from, I'm also speaking to you as observers from Burundi, if we say, say your say, whatever it is, we would be at fault in terms of the facilitation that, on one hand, for all the stakeholders has been done by the government. But remember, our government says it can only assist on invitation. The full-time president appointed by the EAC and the AU is the president you were in service. Now, the other thing that I must just also say
sometimes when members are sitting here, because in South Africa, in terms of the constitution, there is freedom of association, political parties and unions and churches, freedom of association, but also freedom of expression, which is freedom of opinion, or freedom to express a view or an opinion of your party. Sometimes you can say it's your party, sometimes they say it's your view. No matter how wrong it is, we must hear you out. Is it comes from what the French philosopher once said, Voltaire, that you have a right, I'm just paraphrasing the words I'm old now, I can't remember exactly. You have a right to express your opinion. And then he said that I'll defend to death your right to express your opinion, if he disagrees with it. So I think it comes from there. Very old. So what happens here, our media and others, people are free to express their opinion. Now let me then offer my own little comment and views. And I wonder if you'll be able to deal with some of these things. What is the AU, and perhaps the date is 2A, the AU and the EAC saying about the alleged external interference or intervention of Rwanda? And I just wonder if we know what the reason could be. Is it ethnic? Because they share different ethnic cultural and linguistically. Or is it political? Or is it because of the minerals of that country? If that is the case, you see, it's very much on an if. There's an issue that you may not be able to deal with now, but I think that the Burundi must finalize. I hope in the inter-Congolese dialogue they are able to deal with that. See, if the opposition there says, President, you are at fault with regard to the Arusha agreement, and they stick to that, and the president and the people are supporting the president and his party, they say, we are right in terms of the constitution of the country, or we are right in terms of the constitutional court, then you've got a serious crisis in the country, because you've got to determine the supremacy or otherwise of the Arusha agreement. Was that agreement facilitated towards the election of Nkurunziza, and he say he is presiding over that process as a first term or as what? You see, the Arusha agreement, and then when the constitution was adopted, what did it say about the sitting president? I'm not sure if you understand what I mean. And I can just for a minute just go back to South Africa. Come back to what we did here. 1993, we adopted an interim constitution. Because we were not in government. The government that was presiding at the time was illegitimate in the eyes of the majority. But legitimate in the eyes of the minority because they were voting. So it was not the government that grabbed power. It was not the coup. It was an elected government all the year. But it's not legitimate to those who are not allowed to vote, you see. And that's what the conundrum we're sitting with. Then, we used the interim constitution to get in to conduct the elections of 1994. We then, the president, then did not preside over the constitution-making process. The constitutional assembly, or the constituent assembly in our language, or parliament, then had to be presided over by someone else, the current deputy president. So in other words, why do you put the government running besides using the interim constitution? You are making a new constitution for the country presided over by someone else.
well, what are the things of? Now, when the human decision, that constitution was delivered, then it took effect, because then it became an act of parliament. That's the constitution we're using. Now, I'm wondering whether in Burundi, Arusha said, we are going to have an interim government, there's a president, and then they are making a constitution, in terms of which you've got a constitutional court, and the status of that court. Because if this court, as some members were saying, that it then said, no president, you can run for a second term. And others are saying, no, the third term is actually... This third term thing there is actually a big thing in that country, in terms of the constitution of that country. If it's not the constitution, then it must be in terms of the decision of the judges that were appointed by the president. Because if the inter-Congress dialogue does not resolve that, it means the eyes of the opposition, even as they discuss, the president is illegitimate. That is because 70%, no, the judge that is illegitimate because his supremacy versus Arusha Agreement has not been determined. And I think when we assist them, we must convince them, assist them to come to that determination so that in one way or another they accept that. The other matter I thought is very, very important. And I can't remember the page now. See, the president is lifting the warrant of arrest to some. But what is the page? Page 10, I think. Now, who are these others that the president says he will release? And then who are these others that he will not lift a warrant of arrest on? I see that the papers were talking about those who attempted a coup. Now, well, we don't know. Maybe we can answer this question now because President Zuma facilitated this discussion and Museveni will be with us. But again, to use the South African context because there are visitors here. In South Africa, we included extreme parties. Those were extremely anti-black, the conservative party. And those that were extremely anti-white. Can name them outside it. He says, no, not dialogue for the future of South Africa. So that kind of spirit must be exported to Burundi so that the dialogue is all inclusive for all political parties, for all, and in fact, sometimes you may need to grant amnesty to certain people just for the dialogue. I was just saying, to what extent is this a serious matter? And the issue about, I don't know where I see it, this thing that we were saying, this thing is bordering on genocide, it's not genocide, it's civil war, it's not civil war. Whether in the discussion, they will also discuss the possibility of ethnic cleansing, either by the people themselves or indicated at the level of government, and whether in the TRC that we are saying they must get into, one of the things they must put in is the right to exist of different cultural, religious and linguistic communities. Is there in our constitution? Is there in our constitution? Now, that's just another matter that we may need to ask about. And besides this lifting of warrants of arrest, the exiles, are they allowed to return without condition? Our Harare Declaration, one of the things it said was that the political prisoners, then Obama Mandela, that was 1989, must be released, 1988, I'm sorry, must be released. And then it says all the exiles must be allowed to return without precondition. So when President Duterte and then political
organizations in 1990, didn't they accept SACP or accept this particular individual? Because you see, they would have refused. The whole process would not have started if there were conditions like that. And the last one is what Mokalapa was talking about. But it is not a problem for Burundi or for Africa. They know generally agreed to definition of the complete, well, that's my own edition now, peaceful, legitimate, free and fair elections. If you look at different reports about different countries, sometimes they say the elections were peaceful, but were not free and fair, or were peaceful, legitimate, free and fair. But sometimes you still have a government. And sometimes they make those observations. Then they don't and say, this government then must go. So, I think we must just agree over it. When a particular body or bodies, sometimes it's the AU, it's the UN, it's SADC, or all of the regions of Africa, are tasked to go and make observations, therefore to come to a particular determination. And therefore, that makes the point that Honorable Khadel was making earlier on very legitimate. It was very much regrettable that the AU and others decided not to send observers. Because now we have got this problem, and the opposition then says, no, this government is illegitimate. Because you see, that day, that particular day, the 18th of that month, it was peaceful. But the violence that visited the process was such that it had been actually violated. The United Nations, the AU and others can't be able to adjudicate on a matter like that because of the so. Because I'm an observer election, you know, observer meetings. They take place some 3 weeks before if they can pay for them, and then some 2 weeks before. And they do assist, they do compel parties to tone down on certain things, including the language they use. But at least you can know that. And the way they are feeding is actually mudding the political water. So, I think I agree with Honorable Khadel. It's regrettable, given that there is no definite agreement about free, fair elections and how, therefore, the government is no. There was something I thought is the last thing about the role of South Africa. So what we are doing there is training the Barundi diplomats, the TRC institutions. You see that on page 15.
Yes.
So we are not assisting in the political discussions that will make all of these things possible. And can I understand that that process is being presided over by President Museveni? Because it's not that this is good assistance, including what someone was also saying about the Kona funding, it must come back, and then we do all of this. But you see, there's none of this is political here to facilitate a very good, normal political dialogue. I know what President Museveni is supposed to do. I'm just saying, building that kind of political dialogue. It's something we must assist some of the countries in Africa and some of the countries in the world. And that's my last point. And it is that in South Africa, people who have been victimized for over 3 decades, that's over 300 years. Their land taken, their languages undermined, their culture undermined, their names bullied legally in all sorts of ways, have been able to forgive, for us to be where we were, where we are. And we are among a few people who have forgiven so much animosity. Both ordinary people and the leadership of different political parties. There are people or nations who have not forgiven others because of what happened to them. Individuals and party operatives who are still hunted down today because of what happened to certain people in certain countries. Now, in the South African context, for instance, if you do discuss with Afrikaners about what happened during the end of the war, if you have read the book that they released in 1999, celebrating or commemorating, I think it was commemorating 100 years of the end of the war, what even other things that being said today about the English people, you see? But they do live side by side with the English people following the 1910 settlement, you see? Although it was a settlement between the two, I think the black, and then from 1994 for all of us. Now you see, in other words, they still remember what happened to them, but they still live with the English. And we remember what happened to us. We still live with them. So, you see, visitors, I'm sorry, I didn't think I'm included, I'm so you cannot remember. But, these are some of the things that countries may need to learn from the spirit of forgiving among people. Because if you live in prison, because this is what happened to your language, to your religion, to your culture, you remain in prison in that time. You will never arrive in the future. And this is just meaningless opinion, yeah. And it is wrong in the eyes and ears of other people. Yeah. But I've got the right to say. Over to you.
Thank you very much, and the honorable members. Maybe let me start off by just making a broad statement that the AU and the AAC, and in this instance South Africa in particular, we are extremely concerned about the instability in Burundi. I think that's the first thing that we do. We are extremely concerned. South Africa in particular, because South Africa, President Zuma in particular, was one of the mediators during the Arusha process. So there's a feeling within South Africa that we midwifed the birth of the Democratic Republic of Burundi. So we feel therefore that we have got an obligation to continue to work with them towards achieving sustainable stability. That's the first thing that I thought I needed to say. Now, coming to questions in particular, honorably, I think we take a note, you know, it's quite regrettable that AU did not send us efforts. It would have helped if they did. And of course, the continued instability, I made reference to that in the details, I mean, in Burundi. We're quite, all of us concerned. In fact, if there's any one particular focus on resolving the issues of conflict on the continent, Burundi is probably the number one currently. The discussion that took place at the AU summit recently, they were largely around Burundi. Now, then the second question was about the respect for institutions. Let me just, the institution and the court, decision of the court. I think for us, I think that's what the AU has also, for us and the AAC in particular, made a determination that once the highest court in the land determined the legitimacy of the candidate of President Nkurunziza, we then thought that debate is closed. Because we, for a minute, begin to want to continue to discuss a process in a candidate examination made by the highest court. I do know that even our tribe were tempted in the beginning to want to have a legal opinion on whether President Nkurunziza is going for a third or whatever term. We were tempted to do that. And then what would be the relevance of a South African legal opinion on a sovereign state? I do know that some or two countries in the East African community task their lawyers to prepare a legal opinion. And then the question is, what is relevance, what is standing of that legal opinion? So for us, I think we just made peace with this, to say that now the highest court in the land has decided all we need to do, we need to assist the people of Burundi to achieve peace and stability. That's the first thing that is. Now, of course, in Burundi, we then understand the criteria that, as I said earlier on, that this matter, we believe, should then form part of the agenda items that they need to discuss. The harmonization of the spirit and letter of the Arusha agreements, as well as the constitution of Burundi, the current constitution of Burundi. If there's a need to review the constitutional changes to ensure that it lives up to the spirit and letter of Arusha, I think there would be a liberty to do that. We expect them to do that. Now, the withdrawal of the donor funding, the major donor in Burundi, are the Germans. We very few other countries in Western Europe are providing support, but Germany is providing substantial support to Burundi. We have engaged with them. They have not actually withdrawn. What they are trying to come up with a creative way to ensure that the ordinary people in Burundi are not affected by this. So that's where they are in terms of their discussions. We have met with the Americans, last week we met with the American Special Envoy to the Great League. We met the other week with the British Special Envoy on the Great League. I think there's an agreement that the people, the ordinary people of Burundi should not be sacrificed. We need to provide support to them. Of course, while putting emphasis on the need and putting our weight behind the inclusive government, good dialogue. We believe that this process, one other member made a point that it's not an event. I think it was more, it's not an event, it's going to be a process. And it's going to take a bit of a while. I think if you were to talk to these opposition party members that are here offline and hear their perspective on what is going on and hear the government's perspective on what is going on in Burundi, you only come to one conclusion that it's going to take a bit of a while. It's part of the discussion. The heads of state that were there, they condemned in the strongest possible terms the killings, the human rights violations, and everything else. That's what the accommodation said. As I said, the issue of the agenda. I did not discuss the issue of Rwanda. This separation of by Rwanda. I mean, if you look at the Great Lakes region, take the DRC for instance. We know that in the DRC there would be one or two countries in that part of the world that continue to interfere with the internal process in the DRC. We then came up with a framework, a new UN framework on the peace in the DRC that was signed at the beginning of 2013. It was February 2013. In that framework, we came separating the principles that should apply, that none of the member states should interfere in the internal affairs of the member states. If it's clear that we are on record as a continent, as an international community, in that is one of the basic principles of international law, that you must respect the territorial integrity of a sovereign state. And therefore, the alleged involvement of Rwanda is a matter of concern to the continent. And the head of state, having listened to the presentation that were made last week by all the stakeholders, the next step, therefore, would probably be an engagement with the government of Rwanda.
and the special agent to stop this, doing this. In fact, even the UN, the UN Security Council, has expressed a concern. But some reports have come to indicate that indeed they are individuals that are trading sometimes, and they are frustrated, facilitated through the border to create this database in the neighborhood. It's not allowed in terms of international law. So if Rwanda is doing that, if Rwanda would then be on the wrong, and Rwanda would have to be spoken to desist from doing that kind of thing. Now, Honorable Kenya, UN mediators, I think what the UN has done now, correctly so, in our view, they have tended to give space to the AU and the EAC to run this, this matter. And we really appreciate that. And we really appreciate that. Now, you made reference to the visit of President Nkurunziza to South Africa. Indeed, when President Nkurunziza was in South Africa in November 2014, he came here on a state visit. Among the requests that he made was a request to assist with the training, not only of their public servants and diplomats, but also of their security establishment. That's why I was then making a point on the part that talks about South Africa's role moving forward, would be then for us then to look at what it is that we're going to do, training of their army, training of their police, and their diplomats. That's what we're going to be doing. And that's also to conclude the chair on this one, page 15. Page 15 of our presentation is largely a bilateral South African engagement. It does not fall under the facilitation by President Museveni. So South Africa is going to play two roles. One, we are pursuing our bilateral engagement with Burundi, as outlined on page 15. Secondly, we have been, as I said, we've been requested to assist in the facilitation under President Museveni. So the President, therefore our President, is expected to appoint his specialist envoy to Burundi. And that talks to your question then, Honorable Minister Jack, Honorable Jack, as whether we are not going to spend all our intellectual capital. No, President Zuma will have to find a special representative to Will Bachman, yes, I'm sorry. So I just wanted to conclude on that. Then the deployment of the 5,000 keeping force on the chain, whether it was Addison or not. No, Addison is in Somalia. This one, it was a decision by the AU Peace and Security at officials level, and it went to ministerial. I think is right to say that what changed. Indeed, the heads of, remember the two levels, senior officials and the minister, they reported to heads of state. So the heads of state, in their wisdom, decided not to deploy this 5,000 troops. That's the heads of state meeting. We're talking about close to 20 heads of state that met in the AU Peace and Security Council. And then decided instead to support the facilitation under President Zeng. Now, Honorable Mumbana, is Burundi rich?
Sorry, the question was not to who took that decision. Mukalapa was saying why. But of course, if you don't know, it's fine.
Let me just check. But what I'm saying is that, remember, heads of state, two things here. If you look at the concept paper that was prepared by AU Commission, and since then was by the AU President Security, on the deployment of the 5,000 people, it's very clear that the deployment would be done with the consent of the host country. That is very important. At the consent, or with the consent of the host country. Burundi by that time had made it clear that they were not going to welcome that war. Not only Burundi, including certain countries in that part of the world. Tanzania, for example. Tanzania issued a public statement to say that no, they don't think the time has come for the deployment of the 5,000 keeping force in Burundi. So Tanzania, remember, is the chair of the AEC. So we take tune as on the regional body. So therefore, that's why then part of the reason and the discussion that took place was whether we could then afford to deploy without a consent of the receiving state, and if so, what are the implications? And then two, and most important, it was going to be a precedent setting decision. Only once has the AU in the recent past deployed without the consent of the country. It was in Comoros. Tanzania, leader Gaddafi was still around, they deployed it without the consent of the government in Comoros for some years. So this was going to be a precedent setting. So you would have expected, therefore, that the heads of state on the continent would have to apply their minds and see where indeed there are no other opportunities or options available for them to try to deal with this. And in their wisdom, then they decided that instead, let's support and strengthen the facilitation by the EAC led by President Museveni.
There is a political question that I'm trying to answer, right? Because the AU chapter was closed where the government has been without the consent of the host nation, where the threat of the but it's a political question. I don't expect.
No, that's fine.
I'll take it with a relevant discussion.
No, that's fine. The next one was the role of international community in the book. I've already spoken to that and decision of the head of state. The time frame for the resumption of the dialogue, the head of state, the high level visit indicated or advised that President Museveni must engage by the force. So we expect hopefully that before the end of this week, President Museveni will then convene the first session of that. And then the Burundians, without any conditions as determined by the head of state, will then participate in a dialogue. I have already spoken to the issue of the decision of the court. Inclusive dialogue is clearly the head of state has
so,
clearly.
So you are saying there will be no preconditions in the participation?
No.
Will it then include the return of the headline also with a precondition?
Okay. No.
Zuma met the exiles who also belong to different political persuasions. The facilitation, that's like there must be a participation, no preconditions.
Yes. No, maybe let me start by saying that there were five heads of state led by President Zuma. President of Senegal, Gabon, Ethiopian Prime Minister, and Mauritania. Now they met President Nkurunziza. They met the leaders of the political parties. They met the religious leaders. They met the representatives of the civil society. And they also met former president, Ndayizeye. So those are the people that they met. Now, and then they go on and say, but just to talk about this issue now of the dialogue. I just want to get it directly from the committee. To read it as it is from the committee. I just want to read. They welcomed the commitment. This is very important. The commitment of the government of Burundi and the other stakeholders to participate without preconditions in inclusive dialogue under the facilitation of President Museveni. You see, that's basically that's what they say. But we're talking about those that they met. The next step, therefore, would be to try to meet those that are outside the country, the opposition parties that are outside the country, and we believe that they will also then join this process. Then the role of the Ministry of Labour, there's an MOU that has been drafted, it has not been concluded. Now we believe that the process is going to start to finalize it because the numbers have increased. It was not concluded because there were a bit of challenges by the government of Burundi. Now government of Burundi has agreed to allow the 100 military observers, 100 human rights observers. So what is required now is to conclude that MOU. And that MOU then defines the rules, what the mandate, what they have to do in Burundi. Now the issue of terrorism in that part of the world, I think when you look at Rwanda, don't look at Burundi in isolation. You have made a point that in Rwanda, the constitution it has been changed. The president Kagame is going to go for a third term, as the parliament referendum and another term. And guess what? Guess what? They mooted reaction to that by international community. But when it comes to Burundi, it has sustained complaints about whether this was a third term or second term. So for us then in our engagement with our cooperating partners is to say that we need to be consistent in our messaging. And if it is right in Burundi, even in Rwanda, to have a person to stand for a third term, it should also be right in any other country in that part of the world. So that's the issue of consistency that we are talking about. But as we said earlier on, in Burundi, whether if President Nkurunziza is standing for a third or second term, the constitution determines that, and we are not engaging in any longer. Now, Honorable Gentlemen, facing the civil war and what should happen then before you intervene. But thus far, we've got AU a team that is on the ground. The EAC is also on the ground. Thus far, they've not come to us as international community to say that indeed there is a serious civil war in Burundi. There is a genocide in Burundi. And if we're going to have that, I want to believe, therefore, that the provisions of article or of the constitution as would apply, in which case then the continent would have to deploy without the consent of the living state. So I think that's basically that. And that's why a determination has not been made in that regard. Now, I wouldn't want to comment on the people that participated in the election, whether they were forced or not. We wouldn't want to. Now, the participation of South Africa, yes, South Africa, obviously, we expect an invite from the AU Commission for South Africa to send one or two military people to be part of the 100. We expect that. But it also then talks to what Honorable Jackie was saying, he was just sure that cautioning where that deployment might also pose a danger. The MOU that is going to be signed will then spell out exactly what their mandate, their roles, what is the responsibility of the government of Burundi in terms of protecting them, and what is the responsibility of the all Burundian stakeholders to ensure that they allow them to operate freely in that part of the country. That far, there is no decision by the AU to deploy police officers. It was just a South African proposal. It just has been accepted by the AU. The AU thus far has decided to deploy only human rights observers as well as military observers. I've already talked to the issue of the peacekeeping force. Honorable Maira, independence of the jury, I mean, we have made a point, I think we have captured that. Chair, EAC position on the alleged external involvement. As I said, we are clear on this one. We are clear. If any country in that part of the world is involved in disarming a neighboring, then that country will have to be told that it must stop that. And as I said, that would be against the international law principles. However, as I said, the AU high-level delegation, we expect them to engage Rwanda on this thing, and we'll hear what they want. But Rwanda, that far, has publicly denied that they are involved. But we'll leave the rest to the heads of state when they meet with them. Now, whether Rwanda's alleged involvement is ethnic-oriented or whatever, I think on that one, we want to, because we'll be speculating. But for us, we just wanted to state the principles. It's like South Africa. In South Africa, we wanted to be involved in the suit because in South Africa, we could Basotho, and then Basotho would be then traveled to the suit. That would be wrong for South Africa to unilaterally interfere with the internal affairs of the suit because we happen to have people of the same ethnic group. What was there? Or Botswana for that matter. Think for us, the principle. And we want to and to state that principle that no foreign member state would be is allowed in terms of international law to interfere with the internal affairs of a sovereign state. Now the issue of
member wants to come back. So.
Okay. Now, just on the issue, we believe then because it's an issue that is disputed. Of whether President Nkurunziza is the second or whatever term. This matter, as I said, needs to be on the agenda. So there has to be clarity on what the Arusha Agreement says, what the Constitution of Rwanda says. If there is a gap, then I want to believe that the Burundians in that dialogue will then come up with a system, a way forward of how they close that gap. So that is common interpretation and understanding of what needs to happen in this regard. So I think that is what you wanted to say. Exiles, are they allowed to return without condition? I mean, our understanding, Chair, is that when the heads of state met with President Nkurunziza and agreed that the inclusive dialogue must start without precondition, that includes the return of exiles to participate in that. And then, of course, if then President Nkurunziza would have a different view or change his position in this regard, we believe that the chair of the leader of the facilitation would have to weigh in heavily on them to allow, because one, this is a catch word here, an important word, inclusive political dialogue. That's what we want to see happening. Declarations of elections, chair. SADC in particular, even AU, when they go and observe elections, they are guided by the SADC principles governing democratic elections. So they are very clear on what is that SADC would be observing and who they meet and then they will make a determination. They on first guided by the principles themselves, the protocols, and having met with all the stakeholders, including the ruling party, opposition parties, civil society, media, and everybody else, to hear their perspective, what is going on. And then after, not only that, they also then go to the ground to observe the election, and then compile the report that, okay, we observe the election, and this is our conclusion. And so that's the study. We do know, Chair, we can definitely get that. We are increasingly seeing on the continent that the losing party do not accept the outcome of it. It's become a bit of a trend. It's worrying. Patrice Mashuken, too, as long as we have observed the election and in the wisdom of SADC or AU, while there may have been some irregularities, those irregularities are not of a sufficient nature to change the outcome of the election, then SADC would have to declare the election in the manner they deem it. I've already spoken to the issue of H5. I was sitting it's largely bilateral. I think that's basically all the questions then, Chair.
Thanks for the detail, Mr. Makaya. When you were talking there, Honorable Khadebe has been itching to come there, I don't know, on a specific issue or on generalities, and I promised him that he'll come back there.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think that this issue of precondition, that there will be no precondition for the negotiations, I think it is a wrong parameter to move from. I'll make an example. In our case, Chair, when we decided to involve ourselves in the World Trade Center negotiations, that is CODESA negotiations, there were certain things which the participants had to commit in. One, the African National Congress had to suspend the armed struggle on the 2nd of July 1990. So we cannot have a situation that there are peace negotiations taking place but people are being harmed on the other side to come and attack the sitting government. I think that this Ethiopian principle that there can be no preconditions, I don't think it is right. The issue is that everyone must commit to peace. When the people commit to peace, they cannot continuously be armed with a force. So, because the people have to decide what only side that they are saying. I think that aspect here of no preconditions has been overemphasized, and then it's wrong. I think that once the people go to the process, what is very, very important is the policy inclusive dialogue. Everyone must be given the opportunity to come and participate. Those who are in exile cannot be arrested because of the persecutions they have. But they cannot continue being armed. I think that one, because it defeats the very purpose of this dialogue. I think that made me to each name. Again, on the issue, I'm very happy with the stand the Southern government took on the issue of the Constitutional Court ruling. Because once the court has made the ruling, I think everyone's apart. We know that even in America, when George Bush was elected the president, a lot of African Americans were disenfranchised. They were taken off the voter's roll. They did not participate. When the court of law made a ruling that George Bush is a winner, without we had to call him president. We had to support that. I think that the right shoe, which was taken. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And with that, we step up this subject. I think Mr. Mackay, you have done good work. The detail that came out when members asked questions and made comments, the details that then came out were even more educating to all of us here. And I think for that we must thank you. But you not recommend I'm not promoting.
We might see you in the coming at Biko as an ambassador.
Okay, I see. Yeah. No, thank you very much. Now, we must go for the trust and the adoption of the trust plan. Parliament will convene at 3 o'clock. Can I suggest a break for how long? Just before we come in. Okay. At 2 o'clock. Colleagues, let's come back at 1 o'clock. So we're granted a human rights break for 2 minutes. It's 10 to 1 o'clock. We resume only one item.
M-A-K-A-Y.
No. It's up to 1 o'clock, then we deal with the last item. The last item is just 20 minutes. Bergman?
It was not the
what time? With the
I didn't invite the Israeli ambassador, by the way, but I did call him now for a lunch. So I thought if we're going to go at 2 o'clock, it works out better. If we're coming back at 2, that works out better. So then I said, hijack the Israeli ambassador.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I want us to resume now and allow this dinner. Look, now I couldn't have my own human rights break because I got him crossed in into a corner here. Yeah, but I'm going to see here. No, I'm Kalapa. No, it's all I can say. It's not going to be long. What I was saying is that the next item is the adoption of the committee draft strategic plan 15 and 20. Now, I will not get into a long history regarding this. Because I had everything at the trust plantation. That one, we owed ourselves a trust plan. And the trust plan had to comply and in its whatever objectives and goals and whatever, it must be subsidiary or linked to the trust plan of the fifth parliament, which was adopted, I think, last year, June. Next? Around June, last year. We then said let's have our own start there. So we are from that session. Now we have discussion. Now there were areas that we said as a trust plan, we could not speak point by point looking at that. So I want to request you a content advisor. Why not you just draw our attention to those areas. That the trust plan generally is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and then take care of the following areas, then we will then adopt it. Of course, if members feel that there are things that are still missing, we may not adopt, we may then say let those areas be included as further assignment, so that the committee number one must be compatible that it adopts a plan with that thing. And then from there, we then take it to Parliament. To ABC. All of the other processes must then follow. Over to you. Halapa, did you want to comment?
It's straightforward. When we finished with it, we just said the secretariat together with the content, they're just going to fill in the numbers of how many looking at the parliament program. So essentially, just go through those numbers that they put in. Because we've agreed on the general principle of the threat plan, and then it's just for them to align it with the parliament program.
Yeah. Let's see how far you
Thank you, Professor. What has happened is, what I would like to highlight is the number of targets that the committee would be setting itself for. We have looked into the possibility of how many meetings we'll have per year. So that big number of 25, number of briefings, it's in accordance with the parliamentary program, that per year it looks like we're going to be having at least 25 committee meeting sessions. So we are taking that cue. I mean, the cue from what happened. From 2014 we had a baseline of 20. So now we are putting ourselves into a target of 25. So these are just targets which the committee can meet or not meet, and per year. Then the other important thing immediately under that, under the number of meetings, is the number of outreach programs which the committee will take. So there will be only one per year in terms of, you know, the limit of time. I think that is one. And then the other important one, probably if you go to another page, is the legislation. The one where we are going to have now that we have legislation, 2016 is 100% that we are going to actually deal with legislation. So what is going to happen there is that we are going to have 3 days here of public hearings on the legislation. It's normally done in Parliament, so it will be 3 days. Then, since DECO has indicated that SAPA must be coming next year, that's why we have 2017-18 there. We have 5 days, because SAPA is more, it's a broad, it has more sectors and it has more interest, I think, to the public out there. We have to have 5 days. But otherwise, all the processes which are required, we will be able to deal with for legislation. Start by the South African Development Partnership Agency. Okay, sorry, madam. Then there will be public hearings. After those public hearings, the committee will look at the summaries of submissions made by stakeholders and then decide whether they want to call for oral submissions, some of the submissions that have been made. So that will be catered for. Then we go straight to briefings on the issue of treaties. The committee, as one of the mandates, has to look into all the relevant treaties to DECO, international treaties, to see, to assess whether their impact is still needed or whether they're still relevant. Where there are supposed to be amendments, the committee can do so. In fact, even in legislation that is under the purview of the department, the committee has to review that and suggest amendments where necessary. So we have target of maybe 2 meetings to deal with those processes for treaties and legislation. Then the other one is on study tours, which I think will be another one of interest to members. That study tours have been targeted to have at least one this year, because we have legislation so that we can have a study tour in relation to the legislation that we have. And then another one in 2018, then we have SAPA bill. Then in terms of oversight visits, you probably should go to the first page on that, page 31. In terms of number of oversized visits, that would be block number 2. Oversized visits to our oversized visits will have many legs. It will be an oversized visit to missions, oversized visits to ARS project areas, and oversized visits to international organizations where they could be participating. So those visits I envisage to be at least one this year, 2 2017-18, 2 2018-19. So in all, within these 5 years, we hope to get at least 5. You know, the consensus which was raised by the committee. Then outreach, I have already spoken about outreach. So the last page, honourable members, is important. The one which is risk management. This is where the committee will be able to caution itself in terms of when now it's being assessed, or question from time to time whether the committee is achieving its mandate or not. Number one of the major risks is the parliamentary oversight model, which the committee still has to pursue and see, you know, how that can be overcome. And then the other one will be delays in receiving trust legislation and other documents to the table. That is a common, yes, on the last page. These are just caution the members. In a strategic plan, when you have your targets, you must have something that will caution you in case you don't meet the target. And then the other one is the unforeseen complexities and contentious aspects within trust legislation, because when legislation arrives here, it doesn't necessarily mean within a week will be done. It might you know, be other complications which will delay the process. And then the other one is budget constraints. We are all aware that the national budget has, you know, constraints. So it will automatically trickle down to even parliament and committees of planning. So we might be constrained in some of the activities because of budget. And then the uncertainty in socioeconomic environment in the ever-changing international relations is a very fluid sector. So in terms of its nature, things change from time to time. So we may not be able to follow our program word by word, much as we are going to try, because there will be other events coming up which need urgent attention, which we will have to switch over to deal with. And then the other one is a lack of coordinated mechanisms in the context of international relations. This issue has come from the committee in a number of times, and some of the things which the committee wants to do, if this problem persists, it might not be solved this term, you know, all of it, but at least the committee in conjunction with the select committee hopes to achieve this. So it will depend on the activities of the select committee also, whether they're able to actually get leverage within provinces and municipalities. So it's not an matter only with us, but we depend on another committee to do. Then the other one is inadequate confirming processes within the committee regarding international matters. This one is also another problem, because some of the things will happen in other committees and this committee will be left out, you know, and then when by the time the issues come to us, we might also be, you know, late in the processes, or we find that our, you know, issues which are handled by other committees are not being handled properly. So it's not only us, but in our first framework, we have suggested the change in parliamentary program, that one is a given. There will be changes in the parliamentary program which will affect the work of the committee. And then inadequate engagement with the society. Parliament says we should, all committees should have an element of public participation. So it might not be possible for the committee to engage all stakeholders, but we'll try as much as possible to engage them. Chairperson, I think I am done. Thank you very much.
There you are. Earlier on, Honorable Khalafa said, somebody and I like to leave. Said it's straightforward. We don't have the time. It's now 16 past 1. We must discuss the adopt or not adopt, and then have lunch, and then by 2 o'clock there are other meetings. At least for some of them, most of the Honorable Mukhalafa, you're on the floor.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would move for adoption of the program or the spread plan.
Honorable Maya, are you on?
No, it's
only that. So there's no Rwanda Burundi.
Okay.
Okay. No, thank you very much for this event. Thank you also to Zineo and your team for sanitizing areas that my just clear so that the document is about. Now we have a working document. And again, he must then, where does it go from here? He has guiding us. It goes to the ATC. What happened? What happened from
here? We will, following from this chapter, so we'll have the annual performance plan now, to plan now for the year, and then to follow the process can come to.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Chair, subsequent to the adoption, it will be published in the ATC, and then it will also be broadcasted to the parliamentary website.
I'm glad the members, the committee adopted, because we are one of the very few as a structure.
Thank you.